You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, February 29th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Dave Weigel, Slate political reporter, on Mitt stumbling through Michigan, on the snow melting in Maine. Senator Snow is retiring. I thought I'd get a little clever. Also on the program today, Michael Hastings from Rolling Stone magazine on the Department of Homeland Security's monitoring of Occupy Wall Street, other revelations through that Stratfor email dump. Also, hopefully, catch up with him on Afghanistan as well. Ladies and gentlemen, there are some days where at this point in my day, I realize that perhaps there is a God. And perhaps God has dropped his arms. He's a guy. He's an old guy with a big white beard. And he drops his arms down through the clouds from where he lives. He sits there on the clouds, above the clouds. That's why you can't see him, because he's hiding in the clouds. And on a clear day, he took a vacation. He went to Florida or something.
He's on an invisible cloak.
And he drops down. That's possible, too. He also does have an invisible cloak, so he could put that on. And he drops his arms down, and he just sort of cups my buttocks and carries me through the day. You've heard the old saying, when I looked back and I saw only one set of footprints, those were the times that God was cupping my buttocks and carrying me forward. And this is one of those days. For two reasons. One, we obviously had a huge scoop yesterday. We didn't even realize it. Rupert Murdoch called into this program yesterday. Now, it turns out it wasn't actually the real Rupert Murdoch, but that's not relevant to the story. And the fake Rupert Murdoch suggested that he would throw his son under the bus. And in fact, today he has James Murdoch resigning from News International, leaving the country. He has exiled himself from the UK to come over here to run he'll become COO of News Corp with responsibility for global television. You know, here's a guy under serious investigation in Britain. Is this a suitable person to be in charge of a company that gets a broadcast license from the FCC? Now's the time to send in your complaints to the FCC, folks. And then beyond that, just one more element of proof that God has dropped down and is cupping me by the buttocks. A story in Bloomberg with quotes like, "People who don't have money don't understand the stress." That's from a guy named Alan Dluglash. I can't pronounce his name. At an accounting firm. But there's also some other quotes by a guy who is complaining, I don't know, whining, I'm not sure, that, quote, "I feel stuck.
The New York that I wanted is still just beyond my reach. Because the $350,000 he earns, gross, that's a gross figure, folks, not net, is not enough to keep him in the lifestyle that he wants. And his name is, where do I have that? Oh, Andrew Schiff. He is the director of marketing for broker-dealer Euro-Pacific Capital, Inc. Who's that company owned by? That company is owned by, oh, his brother, Peter Schiff. All right, well, we'll talk much more about that story in the better half of the program today. But now we must take a break so that I may bring you the first of our two guests of today. I may not even have to dial, because I think God, on days like today, when I look back and see, where are my fingerprints on the phone? They're not there. And those are the days that God dialed the phone for me. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Slate political reporter Dave Weigel, who crisscrossing the country to bring you all the bloody details of the Republican primary. Dave, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's good to be back. Thank you.
Mitt eked it out last night. Just give me your sense. You know, I know what the conventional wisdom is, but why don't you tell us whether or not you agree with it? I mean, does this obviously doesn't hurt Mitt Romney, but he still has a race on his hand, doesn't he?
Well, he does. I mean, this is something I've been fascinated with probably more than somebody who's actually covering the race should be fascinated with, is the degree to which the media controls whether or not a win is a win, because on delegates, Romney, as expected, won Arizona, and he split Michigan. He spent Rick Santorum 2-1 in order for the right to split delegates with him, which is far worse than last time. I think my look at the map, which the Detroit News put together, suggests that Romney Santorum won 7 of the 15 districts, but possibly 9 districts. And, basically as many delegates. We've all decided, though, that getting 38% in the state is not good enough for him. The way this is real is that the media says that, and then the average person paying attention to this who decides not to donate to Santorum. He might have, they've made a lot of money after the primaries that awarded no delegates whatsoever 2 weeks ago. And, they were not bragging last night in the victory party. or whatever you call it, I guess election night party.
Right.
They were not bragging about the money yesterday.
You know, it's weird because I think to a certain extent, so much of this race has been a function of the way the media interprets what happens on the ground. You know, Iowa ended up Santorum ended up winning Iowa, but it was too late. By the time he had won it, it already passed. But so much of Romney's sales pitch, though, it seems to me, is his capacity to convince people that he can beat Obama in the fall. And so much of that, of the heavy lifting involved in that, is convincing the press that he can beat Obama in the fall. So it's almost as if the fact that the media makes these determinations is baked into the cake. I mean, I don't know if there's been a time where perception and reality have been so closely aligned in terms of the fortune of the supposed frontrunner.
Well, I would say 4 years ago. I mean, and let's not give this mystical ether narrative too much credit. But, you know, 4 years ago, we went through this process where Hillary Clinton won the big states. And if you were next to me, you would see me making, you know, phony air quotes. She won the big states, and it took the little while for the media to understand that this mattered. You know, the Obama campaign was going on conference calls explaining that they had won more delegates. And you sounded kind of like an Obama hack if you're praying this, but it was true. They were doing well in delegates. We argue that money is going to find this, but look, it's not like Romney actually has so much money that he can beat these guys in a submission. He outspent Santorum about 2-1. He outspent him in Iowa about 25-1. There are millionaires who are interested in making, you know, defeating Romney. It's just they need to take some time to explain why, you know, the fact that blue collar voters still don't like Mitt Romney can tend to take the nomination away from him. That's weird, man. I did not wake up yesterday expecting this to spin for Rick Santorum. But if you look at the exit polls, you know, Romney has been doing better with the kind of generic Republican voters. I mean, I feel like there is a kind of a rallying effect. Maybe this happens a little bit in both parties, but more in the Republican Party. People start to want to get behind the front runner and end the dang thing. But, you know, Santorum won Democrats, and that wasn't all because they were coming out and messing with the vote. I mean, Michigan has a history of Democrats coming out in the Republican primaries. It was 7% in 2008. It was 17% in 2009 this time, and Santorum won them about 3-1. And so, I mean, I think that he actually kind of counterintuitively has more appeal to those Democratic voters than Romney does, right? Maybe it's not counterintuitive. I mean, when I was walking around the state, would have taken a while. When I was driving from Detroit to Grand Rapids and stopping off in places, I did meet a lot of people voting for Romney who still just thought he was the word I heard twice was arrogant. He just doesn't wear well on people. And Santorum, he's not even getting a chance to wear on people. I mean, when he surges, he gets kind of coverage of his gaffes, maybe some soft mixed with some soft coverage of his blue collar views. But you know, he's the guy who irritated all of Washington when he was here has actually been kind of obscure on the trail.
Right. And, well, you know, I think there's also the argument that the reason why Santorum appeals to those type of voters is because he's actually articulating, I don't necessarily agree with it, but some form of industrial policy, which has
right.
a very populist resonance. Now, so going forward, one of the things, you wrote a piece on this, and I was actually asked this question last night. This is we have a very different situation between Romney and Santorum than we saw with Obama and Clinton in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, expand on that, because I think it's fundamentally different in the way that there was support, and in terms of like the ideological differences.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the ideological thing. The Clinton-Obama campaign was fought over very skimpy ideological turf. I mean, Obama's rationale as a candidate was that he would have voted against the Iraq War, and she didn't vote. She voted for it and never regretted it. But on substantive policy, you know, even the fact that she had a mandate health care plan and he didn't, They use the grinder down a little bit, but the differences were a little bit smaller. And here Santorum is claiming that Romney validates, how to put this up, being too pretentious. Why shouldn't I be pretentious? He validates the post-progressive movement, post-New Deal liberal consensus, that he says Santorum will undo everything that has wrecked America since, you know, Woodrow Wilson took the oath of office, whereas Romney is a fiddler who, when a bill's been put in front of him that's expanding government, he's going to sign it. And it's pretty comprehensive. I think it's taken the conservative elite a little bit of time to find Santorum credible as a guy who believes that. But, you know, they're fighting over really specific ideological and policy turf. The other thing, I mean, I would add, it's a little bit fraudier, is that just Democratic voters were excited about electing the first female president or electing the first black president. And if you look at the approval numbers in every primary, if you look at approval numbers nationwide, you know, Obama and Hillary, with the exception of Obama dipping a little bit after the Jeremiah Wright thing, were very popular. There are, I think, the people who are really excited about these candidates are the subset of Mormon voters who love Mitt Romney. I think it was 14% in Arizona, and they voted for him about 93-5. And, you know, there's some Catholic Republicans who are really proud of Rick Santorum. But otherwise, I mean, these guys are just – there's not the depth of affection that makes these guys resilient over a long bloody – you know, march to Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, I would characterize the Obama-Clinton primary as a battle between supporters who thought that their person just sort of deserved it more, as opposed to, intensely, or I should say, having any sort of ideological differences, because there, like you say, there was just not that much daylight between Obama and Clinton. The only thing that I can think of off the top of my head, aside from the hypothetical Iraq war vote, would be that Obama did not support mandates in his healthcare program, and Clinton did. We have seen what the result of that was. So, all right.
No, that was really it. History took hold of the campaign. Like, the most progressive candidate on the merits was Edwards, and he just never, I guess luckily for liberalism, never gotten that much traction. But, you know, voters really wanted to elect somebody they fell in love with who would change America from a cosmetic, historical way, as well as policy. And, you know, again, it's different this time. I mean, Romney's actually, like, funnier than he's given credit for.
I laugh every time he speaks, practically.
He's got this, there's a certain kind of cornpone, you know, not even people of his generation. I think it's people who are kind of strictly religious and have this kind of a limited kind of humor. There's a lot of gosh and darn and like pranking. But I mean, I don't think that appeals to Republican voters the same way that, you know, Barack Obama giving an amazing speech every 5 minutes appeals to them. It appeals to Democrats.
All right. Now, you wrote in your piece, if a Republican establishment still exists, this is a nightmare. The front runner who wants to play moderate if he wins, the guy who said that he refuses to set my hair afire and go brutal, isn't reacting well to pressure. Is it your sense? I mean, I saw a quote from Ann Romney talking about how she was pissed at the press. And this seems pretty early for them to be getting frustrated with the press. Is it your sense that Romney is, I mean, holding up? It seems like about a week or two ago, he changed tack and decided I have to lay low. I mean, his speech last night literally was a snoozer, and it seemed almost deliberate. Like, I just need to just look quasi-presidential and let Santorum sort of seem like a lunatic. Is that gonna work? And at the same time, keeping that in mind, I'm looking at the polls and I see Santorum up in Ohio. I see him up in Tennessee. Uh-huh. I see Gingrich obviously up in Georgia, because that's where I guess he has the most book outlets, and has sent all his book publishing people there. And of course, he's from Georgia. But Santorum is second. And those are the biggest sort of delegate rich states.
And more than that, there's a caucus states we're not paying a lot of attention to, that Santorum could surprise everybody in again. I mean, it's totally possible that Romney would lose on states on Super Tuesday.
So what happens here? I mean, is it, on one hand, it seems like Romney, if he wins, he's helped himself because he has this contrast. He looks more moderate to independent voters, although he lost about 10% over the past 6 weeks, as far as I can tell. But he could regain them by being, you know, acting moderate again. But at the same time, he still seems like he's in sort of some type of peril within the Republican primary.
Oh, he is. I mean, it's the smart take. I kind of love that phrase, but I never mean it unironically. The smart take was that after Romney won Florida and Nevada, which he campaigned hard in, he was positioned to sweep everything in February, and instead he lost the two caucuses in February. He barely won Maine. He won Michigan far less than he did last time. Arizona was the one thing he locked down quickly. Now he's proving that in situations where he and Santorum are both campaigning against spending money, he can beat him. But this word momentum, I just wish we could completely exact and knife it out of everyone's vocabulary, because it just hasn't existed. Like, Republican voters don't quite like the guy. Again, there's a slow lurching. You saw it in 2008, really, that there are Republicans who don't pay that much attention or coming around to the guy, and they're going to pay that. But Romney's not McCain. I mean, McCain knows all these factors going for him. I mean, he was generally more down to earth. He was a veteran, which is worth tons of votes in a Republican primary. And it really is. You meet people all the time with military gear at these events, and they all voted for McCain last time. Just factor that into the next few primaries. It's totally possible to imagine Romney underperforming and losing Ohio, and still being positioned to win by stuff later. But we can't compare this too close to any primary before. The Republicans ended up backloading the big primaries that could end this. I mean, California, which I think if it was holding elections today, Romney would win.
Right.
California moved back to June. Texas was going to be in April. It's going to be in May now. There's not the time to give Romney enough delegates to hold the thing down completely until basically the beginning, or I guess the end of spring. And so the hope for this is this kind of sad attrition strategy where Romney just refuses to do any more debates. Ron Paul goes along with him because it's in Paul's interest to work the delegate system, not really to win anything in debates. He enjoys attacking, but the debate is another chance for him to alienate Republicans on foreign policy. They dodge that, and it's just a kind of campaign of who can spend money and get endorsements, which, I mean, this is a factor that we barely pay attention to anymore because of the death of the newspaper, but Romney's getting basically all the newspaper endorsements in every state. I mean, there are those voters who still pick up these things. I don't meet them in D.C. anymore, who just are coming around, but there's so many opportunities for the air candidates to weaken Romney.
It's the amazing sort of dynamic about this race is that on one level it's fascinating and hotly contested, and on the other level it's just incredibly sort of it's drudgery at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like on paper I should be somewhat interested in this beyond. That it should be exciting in some measure, but it just seems like two guys who are just sort of like struggling to get from town to town, like literally on fumes. But let me just ask.
The one point I make is Romney wins Michigan. This first event in Ohio had about 100 people in it.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
That's stunning to me.
One
question about Ron Paul. I read somewhere that Ron Paul was going into black churches in Michigan and campaigning hard there. Was he?
Mm-hmm.
Is Ron Paul doing anything but essentially trying to protect one flank for Mitt Romney at this point? I mean, he's practically running. He seems to be running two campaigns. One is his sort of ground game, like you say, in certain caucuses, and the other one just seems to be as a surrogate for Mitt Romney. To make sure that Santorum just does not have access to a certain number of votes.
I think that's really astute. I mean, their bet from the beginning has been that Mitt Romney would be the consensus nominee of the party, and the votes you can get are going to be from independents and Democrats who turn out in caucuses and really hardcore Tea Party Republicans. And if you just keep getting like 10% of them from state to state, yeah, sure, you helped Romney win, but he was always going to win. Meanwhile, you've got a big number of delegates. The Black Church thing, I was at one of his events. There was a church in Detroit that was, kind of, I was looking around it. It was actually kind of amazing advance work. It really looked like one of those places in some movie about somebody who gets out of the ghetto by dancing, starring Jessica Alba. I mean, it was like this really run-down place with all the beautiful pews had, carvings on them. And he talked to Black students and just kind of gave the same answers about liberty he gives to everyone. It didn't even work. I mean, he did slightly better in Detroit than he did elsewhere. Yeah, he's really just, we're kind of letting him get away with it. But he is running to spread the message of Austrian economics to every corner of the country and then to spread it some more at the Republican convention. And it's just so, again, this is the way the media works is just so odd because he can do this, but you notice, maybe we've had the last debate ever, but in the spin rooms that happen after debates, his staff will be there and no one talks to them. Like the press just doesn't actually write stories about him anymore. It's just, it's the horse race story. It's what it means. I mean, we're just kind of letting this 10% of the Republican Party, kind of grow off in the corner like a weed and ignore it. I mean, I try not to because I think it's fun and it's interesting, but it's not a presidential campaign strategy. It's a let's see how many parties we can take over and then let's see what we can do in Tampa.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, the only thing that I think it reminds me of is Newt Gingrich being on a book tour. But Dave Weigel, thank you so much for your time. Always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. This is so complicated. I feel like I understand it better now. Thanks, man.
All right. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michael Hastings from Rolling Stone magazine. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program as he traverses apparently a snowstorm on Route 87. He should be able to handle that. I mean, the guy's been to Iraq and Afghanistan reporting. 87 is a fairly straight road, so I think we're safe. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, as long as the state police don't mind that I'm probably violating some sort of law about talking on a cell phone while driving, but we won't tell them about it.
All right. Well, let's assume that you're talking on a headpiece and
hands-free.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, good. Yeah. In which case, I'm no longer I'm not aiding and abetting anything. So, all right. Listen, there's a couple of stories I want to talk to you about, and I'm sorry that last time you were on the program we had such technical difficulties. There's a couple things I want to talk to you about, but I want to start with the piece that you posted last night on Rolling Stone, on RollingStone.com, a blog post emanating out of this email dump by from an allegedly anonymous hacking Strat4, and then WikiLeaks releasing these emails. One was about the Department of Homeland Security essentially monitoring Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, that's correct. So WikiLeaks obtained about 5 million emails from the private security company called Strat4, And the WikiLeaks isn't saying where they got it from. That's their usual policy. Anonymous has taken – the activist group Anonymous has taken credit for giving it to them, but we don't really know. And you know, to me, you know, I've been searching through the emails the past couple days, and this was the biggest news, really, I stumbled upon first. And essentially, Stratfor had been given a document, a report that Homeland Security had put together, kind of examining the roots of Occupy Wall Street, of a warning that it could become a threat to the country, essentially, and in quite vivid detail. You know, they did things like checking, you know, who's using Twitter, you know, what sort of social media usage is being going on, what local law enforcement should look for, the impact that the protests had been having. So it's pretty significant from my point of view, even though some might say the report is benign. The fact that you have, you know, a federal law enforcement agency that is putting together reports on peaceful protest movements, I think is somewhat disturbing.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things about this that I find really just really strange. It is, I'm holding it now. It's like a 5-page PDF. It is from Homeland right. Security, the National Protection and Programs Directorate, Office of Infrastructure Protection. And, you know, just first off, what would the reaction be if we find a 5-page PDF color glossy report on the Tea Party? It's impossible to imagine. But
it would be sirens on the Drudge Report for sure.
Oh, and it would be the number one story. I mean, we remember the backlash from just when the Department of Homeland Security said we got to be careful about right-wing nationalistic organizations that proved to be apocryphal in some instances. But there's a couple of aspects of this that I want to ask you about. One is I don't understand what is Stratfor and what is their relationship to Homeland Security, because there's been a lot of talk, and, you know, I've heard people reference Stratfor for a long time as being this sort of just these BS artists, and which is fine, but they seem to make a lot of money off this to people who take them very seriously, who essentially, one could argue, run our society.
Right. I mean, it's interesting, right? Stratfor bills itself as a sort of private CIA, a leading global intelligence firm that corporations can hire, up to paying them fees up to, you know, $40,000 a pop or more for the kind of consulting that they do. Now, it's interesting. A lot of people have said, oh, Stratfor is a joke. It's not a big deal. But I mean, as you said, people take them very seriously. Their ranks are populated with, you know, a fairly well-respected analyst and former government intelligence agents. So if Stratfor is a joke, then one would possibly say that, well, most of our intelligence gathering is a joke. In this case, what were they doing with Department of Homeland Security? It's their, so they also were monitoring the, Occupy Wall Street protest. I haven't published these emails. I don't know if WikiLeaks has yet, but there's a lot of email traffic, thousands of emails about Occupy Wall Street going back and forth within this organization. And the reason why they were so, keen to see what was going on, because they would then, whatever intel they could gather through whatever methods, either public or in this case, you know, from Department of Homeland Security, they could then sell to their clients, specifically their clients in the financial service sector. And there's a lot of warnings in these emails about how these protests are affecting financial services.
Yeah, so that's nice that we are essentially subsidizing the information gathering of a private firm that is selling this stuff to corporations. I wonder when we get our kickback here. But
right.
Well, you know, the other thing I find strange about this is that at the end of the report, it says the report is posted regularly to the Homeland Security Information Network Critical Sectors Portal. This is if you get an email blast from anybody, you see down at the bottom, it's Constant Contact or whatever. This has sort of a similar thing. And it says, if you'd like to become an HSIN.CS member, please contact HSINCS@hg.dhs.gov. Can we sign up? I mean, will we get reports like this?
I, you know, um, I, I haven't tried. It's very possible. You know, I wouldn't be surprised that, because it's not a classified report, but I had never seen it published anywhere. I looked around to see if it had been published, and I couldn't find it. So, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, people might come back and say exactly like, oh, well, this is publicly available. There's no big secret here. Regardless of whether we can get it or not, I would think it would be. My guess would be if I tried to sign up for Homeland Security's reports about, you know, their warnings about, you know, threats to the critical, you know, public infrastructure, they wouldn't necessarily be too keen to send me them. But I haven't tried yet.
All right. Well, we're going to try as soon as we get off our program today. But I want to also flag just a couple of things that you flagged in your piece at Rolling Stone. They say the continued expansion of these protests also places an increasingly heavy burden on law enforcement and movement organizers to control protesters. And then it goes on to say, due to the location of the protests in major metropolitan areas, heightened and continuous situational awareness for security personnel across all CI sectors is encouraged. Critical infrastructure. Who are they speaking to here? In other words, they're calling for a heightened and continued situational awareness. What is that, A? And B, who are they calling for to do this?
I think local law enforcement companies, you know, and I would assume energy companies, transportation companies, you know, one could assume even airlines, ports, these sorts of things. I mean, the question is, you know, who in this Occupy Wall Street movement do they really view as a threat? And the people they list, you know, Anonymous, the hacktivist group, but they also list, not necessarily in the same context, but quite similar, you know, unions, protesters, activists. So, you know, the question, it raises a lot of questions. And you know, people, I'm sure one could say this is just benign. Well, what do you think, Department of Homeland Security? Shouldn't they be monitoring large-scale public protests? I don't know. I mean, look, if the Egyptian government was putting out reports about, you know, we got to watch for these guys in Tahrir Square, we would be up in arms and say, oh, my God, what is the security force doing to these protesters? They're infringing on their rights. But in this case, I guess the regime apologists in Washington are just going to say, oh, it's no big deal.
Well, it seems to me that if they're basically inviting people to get on an email list, well, we send you reports like this. I mean, it would be pretty naive to assume this is all they have. Right. I mean,
I think,
isn't there a version of this that maybe even Stratfor wouldn't have access to? I mean, I find it hard to believe that they're putting out this glossy PDF for semi-public dissemination and they don't have another more secretive dossier, or maybe that we're not getting other intelligence agencies aren't looking into this.
Well, that's the disturbing thing. This is certainly the vanilla for public consumption version of the report, right? I mean, we know from prior reports that there'd been indications that the Department of Homeland Security had helped coordinate the nationwide crackdown last fall on Occupy Wall Street with law enforcement. And then you see a report like this, and it does really make you wonder. Now, also in the context of the Stratfor emails that I've been looking through, which I think is worth pointing out, they discuss a New York Police Department counterterrorism report about Occupy Wall Street as well. And now I wasn't able to obtain that, but Stratfor had it apparently. So they have this counterterrorism report about Occupy Wall Street from the NYPD, and they have a Department of Homeland Security report about Occupy Wall Street. And the question is, you know, is this, you know, I can understand why if you're a big bank, you'd want this information. The question is it the government's role to be providing this sort of thing?
Yeah, I think it's pretty shocking. And I think at the very least, what we have is insight, regardless of what one thinks the competence or the seriousness one should treat Stratfor with. The fact of the matter is that we have insight into at least what the institutional thinking is by these large corporations, because we're seeing one of the major services they pay for to develop their institutional thinking when they look upon what's going on within society.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, and as you suggested too, my hunch would be just from covering these things and just knowing how these sort of large kind of law enforcement agencies work is that we're just seeing the surface. Remember, this is just a report from, as you said, you know, the critical infrastructure department or whatever it was. You know, who knows what else is out there on Occupy Wall Street? And you know what I've said this before, but I think it's worth pointing out. Does Homeland Security have a report on the Democratic National Committee's conventions? You know, do they have it on the you know, watch the RNC delegates as they come to town with the Tea Party? You know, so there's all these other political movements. You know, what if it was a civil rights movement? You know, I mean, people would be, and we know that in the FBI in the 60s, that's what the government spent their time doing, compiling dossiers on Martin Luther King and these peaceful activists. And to see those sort of patterns of behavior, again, with just this DHS report, we don't know the extent of it, but we get a sense of it, is very disturbing. And you combine that with the NYPD spying scandal. We know they're spying on a bunch of innocent Muslims from Yale to elementary schools in New Jersey. You know, I think it's a wake-up call from what's been going on this past 10 years.
Yeah, and the last thing I want to point out about this PDF report is it's dated October 2011, as if this is sort of a regular, you know, volume one, issue three type of situation. I wonder, you know, has anybody asked Department of Homeland Security if there is a December 2011, if there's a January 2012 version, if there's a February 2012 version?
I have not yet. I mean, one of the we were under pretty intense deadline pressure. I literally, you know, I put this up as soon as I could do it in a diligent way. But this is sort of the beauty. I mean, WikiLeaks gets hammered all the time, but in a way, this is sort of the beauty of WikiLeaks and this sort of reporting and the partnership that Rolling Stone and McClatchy have engaged in this case, pretty limited but still significant. In that, you know, this hopefully will open up lines of questioning that otherwise would not have been there. You know, right. This is just one, you know, glimpse of what's clearly a story that could have massive proportions. You know, if people started really digging in to see what wait a second, you know, exactly as you said, is this volume one? What does volume two look like? What's the volume in November once you have, you know, things going down in Oakland like they did in other places where there actually was violence? You know, what's the level of monitoring that's going on of peaceful activists? What's the level of monitoring going on that activists who may be, you know, the black bloc guys, the anarchists? You know, what sort of files are being produced on them?
Right. I mean, I think people have to, at this point, just contemplate for a moment that if Department of Homeland Security is disengaged in October 2011, the idea that they would just say, OK, we've written our 5-page report, I'm done, that whoever is involved in doing this investigation just rolled it up and said, OK, we've done our job. It's beyond naive to assume that. And I just want to turn for a moment. I know you're driving, but I know that's also a long, boring road. So a couple of weeks ago, you had a piece up about a Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, who was a 17-year Army veteran. He submitted a report, I guess two reports, one of which you got a hold of at Rolling Stone. And then just tell us about that report. Tell us why that report was so damning.
Well, this was so Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, an active duty Army officer, had compiled two reports, a unclassified report that he submitted to Congress and to the Pentagon to release publicly, and a classified version of the report. The unclassified version of the report, which essentially said the senior leader, military leadership had been engaged in a pattern of deception of the American public and laid it out in pretty stark detail about what that meant and how they'd been doing that over the years in Afghanistan. The Pentagon didn't want to release the report. I ended up getting a copy of it. We posted it up online. And again, it's a devastating indictment of the war in Afghanistan. And what's most amazing about it is that no one really disagreed with it. You know, there was not much pushback, at least in terms of the substance of the report. We saw pushback in terms of a campaign against the whistleblower, Colonel Davis. But again, I mean, you know, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with some of the issues that will be in the report, the total lack of success with the Afghan army after we spend $11.6 billion a year, and it's still totally infiltrated by the Taliban, drug use, completely incompetent. We have statement after statement from senior military officials that it's clearly they're lying. I mean, and this is the amazing thing about this report. It's not so much what it says, though that's important. It's the fact that a 17-year Army vet who's done four tours, who's active duty, working at the Pentagon, decided that it was such a moral imperative that he had to come out and sort of set the record straight.
Can any lieutenant colonel write a report like this? I mean, under what auspices does he file a report like this?
The report was filed as his own kind of, I guess you could call this freelance, kind of just freelancing to let Congress know to what he was feeling, doing his moral obligation as an officer of the United States Army, that he felt he had a moral obligation to expose or to point out what he felt were things that were not being told straight to the American public. So he was sort of a freelance thing, but he got clearance to do it in terms of he went through all the right procedures in terms of handling the classified information, going to the Congress first, and also submitting it to the Pentagon first. So this did not catch them by surprise. He went through all the proper channels to do it. And it just shows that, you know, no one is being fooled anymore by this stuff. And no one even really bothered. The fact that, you know, no one bothered to kind of even try to defend it, and they instead just tried to attack Colonel Davis's credibility, tells you quite a lot about the argument for staying in Afghanistan.
Am I wrong in my sense that this got very little coverage? I mean, you know, it's almost there's the same sort of feeling, I guess. I see this response now across a different couple of different stories, including the WikiLeaks and Stratfor story. This sort of cynicism of, you know, I mean, I saw people online talking about or on Twitter, some journalists saying, you know, this Stratfor leak is like the cables leak. It's stuff that everybody already knew and didn't really care about. And I just wonder, like, do reporters realize that even though they know about this stuff and they don't think it's worthy of disseminating to the American public, that the vast majority of Americans have no idea about this stuff?
Yeah, I am stunned by the out-of-hand dismissal of yet again of WikiLeaks, right? We have – look, there's a lot of things you can criticize about WikiLeaks. But you have to admit that they have been involved in some of the most significant scoops and stories of the past 20, 30 years in journalism. I mean, look at the impact of cables. I mean, there's been over 100,000 stories around the world that have derived from the WikiLeaks cables.
I'll tell you something. I go on cable TV every week, and I would say in 2011, nearly 50% or more of the times I went on those shows referenced information that came from those cables, and very often not even referencing that they came from WikiLeaks. I mean, it became the basis of literally tens of stories that just I doing 15 minutes a week on these cable stations were talking about it. It almost as if it went from this is not relevant to this is information that is just out there that we don't even realize came from WikiLeaks.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, part of the knee-jerk establishment reaction to WikiLeaks is just that. You know, it's they view it as a threat, and the sort of DNA to try to dismiss the threat is to pretend it's not a big deal. As they pretend it's not a big deal, you know, Assange is under an investigation and possible U.S. indictment. Bradley Manning has been in jail for over a year. And they go out of their way to just kind of contemptuously to speak about WikiLeaks and Assange and Stratfor in the most contemptuous terms. I mean, I think there's something so perverse about that. What journalist in his right mind is going to say, oh, yeah, I don't want to look at 5 million emails from one of the world's leading private intelligence firms, you know, even if they are a joke, you know? I mean, it just, to me, is so shocking. And I've just scratched the surface over a couple-day period looking into these things, and I've had two stories out of it. And in both stories, you know, there's been terrific response from the public. And there was terrific response from the Colonel Davis story, at least in terms of Rolling Stone and web traffic and things. You know, the Colonel Davis report also got a huge response. And how is that treated by the you know, elite media in the Beltway? I'm sounding like Rick Santorum here, but he was dismissed. You know, it was completely dismissed. Oh, this guy is not to be taken seriously. And I just think they're really, really missing the boat. And God bless them. A lot of them do great work. But I think, you know, they're just missing the boat on this whole story.
Well,
I
have two responses to that. One, you can thank them for the web traffic that you're getting because you have less competition. And two, you just got to get going to more parties, buddy. You're just staying
exactly.
at home too much. That's your problem.
I know. I'm not hanging out with the right people, apparently.
All right. Well, Michael Hastings, thanks so much for joining us. Please drive carefully. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it. Take care anytime.
Okay. All right, folks. We've got to now. Oh, wait a second. Wait, stop the music. In the better half of the program, I'm going to talk more about this Andrew Schiff show. But yesterday, I didn't plug becoming a member. And you know how many members we got? None. We got no members. We got donutted yesterday. Is that the word? What am I looking for? So, folks, we need members to support this program. I've just ordered a cough button. Do you understand? And apparently it cost $49. I found an even cheaper one. Thank you to the emailers who emailed me the cough button thing, because I talked about this on the post show yesterday, that, you know, you want me to get a cough button thing, and it turned out to be cheaper than I thought. Of course, I got to get cables. Got to get extra cables. And we did get that processor gate, and I ordered it in anticipation of all the new members we would get who would appreciate. Now, for some reason, Michael Hastings driving in a car on a snowy highway sounded great, whereas Weigel sounded mediocre. But a processor gate would have made both those calls sound just pristine. So please become a member today at majority.fm. It's a very easy process. You click on a couple of things, and then you become a member. And then you have access to the full, yes, and we have an in-house tech department. What does that mean? Oh, and thank you for taking the survey. The survey is now, well, is it closed? I mean, it is closed. Well, if people want to take it, it doesn't hurt. But we'll have another survey that we're going to probably do in a couple months that it will get more granular in less about marketing, more about what you like about the show, so that we can constantly improve the show for you. And one of those ways, I know one of the things would have been he clears his throat on air, or he coughs, or he sniffles. And now you won't have that because we're going to get a cough button that hopefully will work. So please become a member today. You can also support the show if you buy your junk through Amazon and you're not buying it through our Amazon link. I don't even know how you live with yourself. I really don't. It's the easiest thing. It's a one-time thing you got to do. You go to majority.fm. You click support the show. You click on the Amazon link. So we're up to 3 clicks now. All right, fine. Then you bookmark that. And every time you purchase something on Amazon, you just start at that bookmark. You will notice no difference. But soon I will be able to compete with Andrew Schiff in whining about the hundreds of thousands of dollars that I'm earning off of Amazon because of your just taking those 3 clicks. We'll talk more about that story in the better half of the program. And also, as always, justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, organic. I think Los Diosos is my favorite now. I keep dancing around, but I think Los Diosos is the one that's my favorite. I haven't bought the chocolate because I can't have chocolate in the house because it will not last. I will eat it all. The tea, I don't drink tea. Nikki does. But I just worry about the coffee. And you get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. What else? Give us a review on iTunes. Do you listen to the show on iTunes? I know you do. I know at least, what is it, something like 49% of you do? I don't know what the stats are any given day. But give us an iTunes. And even if you don't listen to it on iTunes, why don't you go and review it so that we get more members or just more listeners? Tomorrow on the program, I don't know. See, it's a 24-hour job. Soon as we go into the after show, the better half of the show, then I start thinking about tomorrow's show. That's it. Tonight I'll be on the Young Turks, and see you in the better half.